Matt McNeil, thanks for being with us today. Things worth keeping, the value of attachment in a disposable world. Christine Harold is kind enough to join us, a professor of communication at the University of Washington. She's the author of Our Space, Resisting the Corporate Control of Culture, which was out in 2007. This is her follow-up book. She's kind enough to join us today to talk about this book. Hi, Christine. How are you?
Hi, Matt. I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I got to tell you, this. When I saw this book, I said, ooh, I got to interview her. I got to talk to her because I think I am a person who can't stand with the keeping up with the Joneses crud that this country sometimes becomes. And you the concept of stuff, attachment, is such a large one. But at the same time, we also know we've got a lot of global problems, the environment, the economies and stuff like this, that that make something like this attachment, just addressing it and saying, well, I'll just get less stuff. It's not nearly as simple. Talk a little bit about this book, because you came at this from a kind of a unique approach, saying that attachment isn't bad. You just have to be smarter at it, correct?
Yeah, I think you're right. I feel like so much of the kind of messages that we get from the environmental movement, which are so well-intended, right?
Yes.
And there are all kinds of ways in which we do need to reduce, obviously. But I think one of the things that we've seen is that those calls for us just to sort of shop less, or, you know, that if you care about the environment, that you need to somehow detach yourself from your love of things or be an ascetic in some way. And I think what I'm wanting to argue here is that maybe we could capitalize on the fact that humans do imbue objects with meaning and memories and all sorts of things that make them meaningful to us. And so are there ways that we could capitalize on that to marshal that love of things rather than ask people to deny that? And so I look at a variety of sort of trends and ways that people are experimenting with the objects in their lives. Because you're right, the truth is that we just have so much stuff in our homes and in our lives that most of it becomes meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the socioeconomic spectrum. I mean, it isn't just wealthy people who have a lot of stuff. Everyone has a lot of stuff. There have been studies on children's toys where it didn't matter the income of the parents. Children had something like 30 times more the amount of toys than they had in the 1950s, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just something that we're all grappling with.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the things that's happened. Sometimes you need a massive event to have a change in society and how we look at things. And I think when you look at this pandemic, we are all of a sudden in our house. And I was like a lot of people. I'm looking around. I was like, I have a lot of stuff. I have put attachment to it. It doesn't – or meaning to it. It doesn't mean there's a lot of great meaning to it. But it was when I'm looking at it, I'm like, why do I have some of these things? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's like I remember when I bought my house and I said, well, I need a ladder. Well, and I still use the same ladder. I'm getting great value out of it. It's not – you know, some grand attachment. There's purpose there. But at the same time, I also like, okay, do I need all the Twins bobbleheads? You know, I've got them all. I've put them in a grand place of display. But, I mean, do they really need to be there? And right. I think that's causing, I think, a lot of people to step back and you know, do what you're kind of saying is really the meaning here. What is the meaning and what's the value of we're adding to these things? Is it fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I'm certainly, at least not in the book, advocating that people need to minimize. This isn't a call for minimalism, which, as you probably know, is a big trend that we're seeing as well. This is about trying to think about what is it, why is it that people value some things more than others, and how can we kind of play up the things that people do value. So, yes. Right in this moment of so many of us being quarantined and others of us being unemployed or furloughed and so on, that you see a rise, even though, of course, I wrote the book before COVID, you see a rise of many of the trends that I write about in the book. So first, for example, the decluttering trend, right, really popularized by Marie Kondo in her book, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, and a lot of people are probably familiar with her Netflix series. people are calling it corona cleaning, right? Where people are going through their homes and, you know, we're in our homes more, we have more time, at least some of us. And we're starting to kind of feel that shift of, do I need all of this? Mm-hmm. In fact, the Goodwill in Los Angeles actually had to put out advertisements saying, please stop donating stuff. We can't. They were so overwhelmed by all of the people in Southern California who were cleaning out their homes that they couldn't, you know, deal with all the stuff that was coming their way.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, one of the trends that I look at is things like DIY and crafting and the makers movement and people really starting to find value in learning how things work or learning how to make it themselves. We're seeing those things a lot right now as well, right, with the trends of people making bread and making homemade meals, people who might not have had the time to explore cooking before or picking up old hobbies. That sort of thing. So I think, and of course, we're shopping less. Many people are unemployed or underemployed, but obviously a lot of the shops are closed. And I think it gives us this moment to kind of think about and shift our perspective around that impulse. Because, of course, the marketplace is very good at getting us to be attracted to things and to want things and to have that kind of moment of like, ooh, that looks cool. I want that. But there isn't really as much thought that goes into how can we design and market things that people will want to hold on to
mm-hmm.
And keep in the long run. And so I think we're just kind of in that moment where, I mean, I'm not naive. I think we will go back. People will go back to their shopping. But I do think this shift offers us an opportunity to kind of think about those impulses that we have, because we haven't been able to act on them the same way. People can't go impulse buy at the mall like they could.
And I think this is one of the reasons I like your approach, is because it's different. It is not turning your house into a museum. You know, it's not basically unloading all your stuff, because there is value in attachment. But at the same time, you need to be smart. I think I like the concept of having to be smart about it, because you're right. The disposable world that we live in doesn't really give us great value and ends up, as you point out, making far more trash than if we were smarter about it. Doesn't mean you can't have the attachment to the things. It means more of the idea of that, you know, if you're going to have attachment to things, make sure it's something worthy of attachment.
That's right, and that's going to be different for everyone. But
yeah.
I think that this notion that being smart about it in part means, you know, we've kind of been trained. I think this generation, there's so many things that are cheaply made overseas, you know, cheaply had on the shelves of Target or Walmart, and we don't think about where did this thing come from, who made it, what is it even made of. Where will it go when I'm done with it? And so I think one of the things that I explore in the book is different ways of kind of opening objects up so that they're just not seen as this kind of holy other to us on a shelf that's just there for us,
mm-hmm.
but that it also has a lifespan. And that if we, you know, that's why something like maker culture or crafting becomes interesting for people, I think, is because it kind of makes that black box of like, oh, it's just this thing that somehow arrived in the world and you don't think about it, but it starts to open it up and say, oh, what are its components? What are its materials? You know, what are sort of the physics that go into making this thing work? I think there's a real hunger for that from shows about these topics, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see lots and lots of shows on cable precisely about how things get made that seems to really capture people's imagination right now. And I think all of that, you know, I think it's easy to kind of say to poo-poo some of those things. But I think we are in a moment. I think you're right that COVID has just intensified that, or I should say quarantining and the economic downturn has intensified our kind of slowing down over the stuff in our lives and thinking about it more.
And I think, like you said, I don't know if you necessarily can say a certain attachment is good, a certain attachment is bad, but it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. If someone is making a needlepoint for someone as a gift, that becomes a much – that's very understandable. My mom mm-hmm. made this for me, or my daughter made this mm-hmm. for me. That attachment is – no one really questions that. I like your topic. I mean, we're in Minneapolis, so Target is in our veins sure. in Minnesota. But, you know, as you talk about in the book here, the ways that people get product attachment – by pleasure, by self-expression, group affiliation, and memories. They try to do that. And by the way, that copies over into radio advertising quite a bit. But when I think about this, you talk about – my grandmother had a spatula in her kitchen that was probably the same spatula she bought 100 years ago, sat there. Mm-hmm. No one really thought that much of it. And you remember her cooking with it and stuff like this. Myself, I had to go get a spatula, and I just – you know, and I know better. I know that if I go to Target, I'm going to buy a piece of crud, plastic – like you said, some guy, what are these used for? Oh, pancakes. Okay, great. You know, they're making it. It sends on out. I think I actually tried to flip a slightly larger than average pancake and the thing busted. And I was like, what's the value here? I myself, though, am to a point the culprit because I added value. I bought something that, like I said, I didn't think about it, the concept of it, where it came from, mm-hmm. and the fact of where it's going to go. Now there is a piece of plastic here that if it doesn't get recycled in some responsible way, is just going to sit in a landfill forever, and that does us no good.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously you're not alone. We all do that. Yeah. And so this isn't – I don't necessarily am not asking us to – you know, meditate on every kitchen utensil that we need to buy, right? I mean, that's obviously a heavier lift psychically than any of us can probably do. But I think just, and there's also movements afoot, by the way, for example, the cradle-to-cradle design movement and others who are exploring with like, okay, well, those things that are disposable, let's make them out of materials that are disposable, right? Those things that are kind of ephemeral and they come and go and you need it for a while and then it outlives its use and you toss it, then let's think about what we make those out of. Mm-hmm. And then are there ways we can double down on the durability of those durable goods that people want to hang on to, right? So there's a great design scholar named Jonathan Chapman who talks about, you know, that designers and engineers, they can make a toaster that lasts forever, but it's making a toaster that somebody is going to want to keep forever. That's the challenge, right? Because then it's about you're challenging things like trends and aesthetics and the kind of quest for novelty and the allure of precisely places like Target. And I actually I have a chapter on Target, and I am surprisingly, I think, to some readers, I see some positivity in what they have to offer. But the endless onslaught of plastic is not one of them. Well, I do think that they get people interested in design, which I think is an important step.
Well, and I think I remember the first time I walked into the difference between a Walmart and a Target. And Target, the design, the feeling of the store, it didn't feel, well, frankly, dirty. I didn't feel like I was going to some place where my, you know, next to the cheese puffs was a DVD rack, was a bin of underwear. You know, it just mm-hmm. was kind of one of these things. But at the same time, the design, and I like your concept because there's a very practical nature to what you write here, and that practicality goes on to the end here. But in regards to the trash we create, but I think that it's, I agree. I think Target does a good job at some point with design and giving some purpose to it. But I also, to a point, feels like the first when they launched CDs back in the 80s, and they would release the CD in a big square box with plastic mm-hmm. wrapping around it. And people were like, why are we releasing this inside of this box? And we created this plastic. And yeah, it was a new toy, and we looked at it, and we liked it. And eventually, and fairly quickly, actually, I think we scrapped those large rectangular boxes that the mm-hmm. original CDs came in. But that's what kind of sometimes Target feels like, is because I've had kids, I've gone to Target a lot. It's like I said, it's in your blood, Minnesota.
Sure,
and sure. as you say, there's tons of disposability, there's tons of not very well made products, and tons of extra wrapping and packaging that is not necessary. But at the same time, you still keep going there because, you know, it's, you know, convenience, ease, whatever it is, the purpose, the attachment that you act, you give to these things. And I don't know. Like I said, I think there is, I agree with you, there is a bit of a double-edged sword with the concept of it because it does give you what you kind of need in this world. But at the same time, I think you need to be smarter when you go into that, a place like that and fulfill your needs for attachment.
Yes, absolutely. And Target and IKEA as well have really mimicked some of the rhetoric of kind of early 20th century design movements like the Bauhaus, which was this like design for the people by the people, right? That it was going to be about the people taking over the factory and making beautiful things available to everybody. And Target has really borrowed, in fact, if you look at their early rhetoric when they're launching the big design, their big design piece with Michael Graves, for example, in the 90s, it was a page right out of the Bauhaus Manifesto, right? That it's like, it's designed for everyday people, not only the elites. And that's a compelling message, right? And IKEA has similar sorts of rhetoric. But at the end of the day, the kind of politics that come with that call is completely absent in Target, right? This isn't designed by the people for the people. It's not stuff that's, you know, where the people own the means of production and so on. Mm-hmm. That said, it is one step toward kind of getting people conversant in a language of design, people thinking about design, people, following designers. Target has been really a huge part of that. And so it's just one step towards what I talk about as an opening up of objects where they aren't, you start to kind of think, oh, what's its form function, right? Or what's its, you know, you start thinking about a little bit more, or at least there's a grammar or a vocabulary that Target has popularized that is certainly not particularly productive in and of itself, but it's a step in a direction that I do think is potentially productive.
And as your book points to, I mean, if we don't start dealing with this in a practical manner, that people are going to want things. They want to give attachment. They want to buy things and give purpose things. But if we don't start looking at this in a more effective way, you're right. The antiquated view of just we're going to, you know, everything's going to be made of hemp. Everything's going to be recyclable. That's a world that most people are not going to – we know it's there. We just don't do it. So if we don't address this from a more practical direction – that we are going to fill up this world with debris, and that's not the way we want to go. I mean, we already have such problems with the amount of trash we create.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And so one of the things that I do at the end of the book is just kind of, so throughout the book, I kind of identify these different kinds of value. So project value. Oh, I had a hand in making that thing, even if it's just putting together a bookcase from IKEA, right, that there's, you put some effort into it, so it has a little bit more value to you. And there's a whole study of this called the IKEA effect by some scholars at other universities, and it's powerful. Ritual value, right? That it's like, yeah, maybe this mug is from Target, but it's what I fill my I use it for my coffee every morning as I, you know, start my day. It's imbued with ritual. Yes, it might have been mass produced in China and I bought it at Target, but it's become a part of a larger practice in my life, for example. And so then I look at the end of the book, it's like, are there ways as designers, as marketers, as retailers, as consumers, are there ways that we can kind of explore heightening and intensifying different kinds of values in different kinds of products? So is there a way to kind of hack the psychological attachment to objects so that durable goods actually become more durable and they don't just end up on landfills? Won't be the case for everything. Not everything's going to be meaningful, right? Some things just aren't. They're just useful. Mm-hmm. They serve a purpose. But I think there's a lot of room for us slowing down, thinking about more, the ways that we attach to objects, and are there ways for the marketplace to intensify that attachment?
Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. Christine Harreld, congratulations. This is actually a very interesting read. I think if I can be blunt, I think you're going in the absolute correct direction. I think this is where things are going. That minimalism approach, or just this everyone has to, you know, become, you know, kind of this, you know, new age earthy type, I think is not a realistic one. This is the way I think things are going to go. I congratulate you on that, because that this is a very good book. I appreciate the time. Thank you very much, and all my best on this.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me. All thanks right. A lot.
We'll take a break. Matt McNeil right here on AM 950.